Welcome to Democracy in Color with Steve Phillips, a color-conscious podcast about politics. I'm your host, Steve Phillips. And in this 2024 election year, something is on the table that they call a trifecta. And that's where one party controls the White House, the Senate, and the House of Representatives. And it's able to be able to move significant legislation and, in theory at least, make major changes. And while most of the attention this year has been on combating the existential threat of fascism posed by Trump, from the standpoint of rebuilding this country and moving it forward towards the kind of hopeful and ambitious goals and vision we want, we have to also pay attention to the other bodies. And today we'll look at the fight for the House of Representatives. And in trying to understand that situation, we have to focus on the right issues and the right lens and the right ways of analyzing it. Too much attention is paid to the moods and attitudes of and supposedly shifting allegiances of voters. And this happens in politics in general, in terms of people looking at what's going on, but that lens is even less useful in looking at Congress. That fight is largely about math, far more than psychology or clever communications. And spoiler alert, the math says that Dems should absolutely take back the House of Representatives this year, should actually never have lost it in the first place in 2022. And so since this conversation will be both about the battle for control in the Beltway and a discussion grounded in data and facts, I am joined not only by my co-host, Charlene Chang, but also by our esteemed data doctor, the inimitable Dr. Julie Martinez-Ortega.
Hi, Steve. Great to be here with you.
Hey, Julie. So great to have you back on. We've missed you. It's been such a long time, it feels like. And Steve, yeah, I'm looking forward to breaking it down today with you two, my favorite political nerds. And yes, we're just going to get into some of the numbers and break it down. And just, I think listeners are just really what you're going to get is you're not going to get anywhere else, this perspective and this analysis. And Steve, to start off, can you remind listeners what the new majority index is and why you created it?
So Julie and I worked together to create the new majority index 2 years ago. And it's really to try to bring to an analysis around what's happening in politics in general and happening in congressional races in particular, the reality that different racial groups have different voting behavior. And it's a very undeniable reality, but few people in politics want to acknowledge it or rather face it. Right. If you look historically at presidential races going back all the way to 76, when they first started doing exit polls, 88% of African Americans have backed the Democratic nominee. And the majority of whites have always backed the Republican. And so it's a very fundamental piece. It's kind of the political manifestation of what Issa Rae said was at the Oscars or at the Emmys, where he says, "I'm voting for everybody black." Right. And so right. There's a mindset that is a reality of people or if they look at voting decisions, but people don't want to talk about it. And so there's been little effort to incorporate it into analyses, even though if you really want to understand and make, you know, predictions and assessments, it's a pretty important data set. So that's why we created the New Majority Index, was to really be able to look at the actual electorate, what real human behavior is, and be able to try to develop that level of understanding of what's going on in these congressional races.
Julie, how is the New Majority Index, which we call NMI for short, different from other political indexes, or is it indices, from other political indices like the Partisan Voter Index, which is referred to as PVI, and that's a very kind of popular standard index that was developed by the Cook Political Report. How does the NMI differ from the PVI?
Right. So there's also a DPI that people refer to, which is the Democratic Index. So there's, in addition to what Steve mentioned, with there just being an incredible correlation between the race at a group level and which party the members of that race support, particularly at the presidential level. In addition to that, there's also an incredible difference in participation, civic participation levels of people of color for all sorts of reasons, primarily racism. And so participation rates are what we consider an important part of the NMI. It's an important factor that we included in the NMI so that we could really capture both those racial differences as well as, in terms of partisan preference, as well as the likelihood that voters of color will, in fact, participate, cast a ballot in any particular election. And there are a lot of things that we can do to move the turnout rates that we'll talk about in a bit. But that's a really movable thing that needs to be included in any sort of calculation. So the NMI goes beyond PVI and it adds two additional key data points. The first is the full racial diversity, the demographics of all people who are in an electorate within a specific congressional district or state, whichever we're analyzing. And by that, I mean the people who are citizens and of voting age. So they may have never registered to vote. They may have never cast a ballot, but they're living in that district. And so we incorporate the racial diversity of that full electorate in our model. We also look at the turnout rates among the different racial groups and see the difference between voters of color versus white voters, which in almost every, but I'm just going to say almost just to be careful, almost every district is going to have higher white participation than people of color participation, again, because of racism historically, as well as a lot of the active things that current Republican politicians are pushing as far as making it much more difficult for people to, one, register and two, cast ballots.
I just have it. Thanks, Julie. I just to say, ever since you and Steve have put together the NMI, also Democracy in Color, rolling it out, and it still blows my mind and kind of makes me mad each time I think about the fact that there are far larger entities out there and longstanding sort of industry standards, sort of like Cook Report putting out PVI, and that it still boggles my mind that nobody else has done this, and yet so indicative of what and where we are still as a country. But I literally, just hearing you say that again, I just go, I can't believe nobody else has done this. I'm glad that we're doing it, but it is kind of maddening to say like that you had to wait until Steve and Julie and Democracy in Color did this. Steve, so if there is one major takeaway that listeners should have at the end of this episode, what would you like that to be?
Yeah, well, just even before that, I mean, to your point about how it is kind of mind-boggling others aren't doing this, I mean, it really is kind of an emperor has no clothes kind of a situation, is that it's obvious, but people are very uncomfortable talking about it. And so they want to talk about everything else than about the actual reality. And so, you know, it's just kind of where we are at in our society. People feel like, you know, oh, it's due of race. Are we allowed to talk about that? You know, and so they just really don't deal with that.
I think it's actually really important to note for people how critical PVI is. I mean, PVI from the donor perspective is huge, right? Because very few people are going to be willing to back a candidate as great as they might seem if they're in a district that PVI says is not winnable for a Democrat. And you have to make a whole case for why you really couldn't. You have to spell out the fact that there are all these voters, one, that are not participating, and two, that are people of color who would vote for you for as the candidate if we could just invest the money and do what it takes to motivate them and get them to the polls. So we have got a number of districts around the country that should, for under any metric, be Democrat-held seats, but are not because donors and party operatives refuse to see them as that, when all they can see is, oh, that's an R+1 district. What's an R+1 district? Because R+1 is based only on what's happened in the past. It's not based at all on what could have happened in the past or what could happen today and tomorrow.
Right. They don't see the potential. And that's what led Biden to say on election night about Georgia, right? Georgia, that's not one we expected, because he couldn't see the potential. His campaign didn't invest in it. And I've told this story before, but I want to tell it again because it's really relevant to this whole situation or how you look at congressional districts. So in 2018, two major donors came to me, each wanting to put $500,000 up to try to help take back the House of Representatives. And they were looking for suggestions around where to go. And then I talked to Julie, and we identified a district in California that was largely, it was like two-thirds Latino, and yet it had a Republican representative who had won relatively narrowly, but there was like 100,000 eligible non-voting Latinos in that district.
Wow.
The Democratic Super PAC told these donors, well, that district, that district has a lot of Latinos in it. They don't vote in midterms, so we should not go into that district. That is what the tippy-top consultant advice to the Democratic Party was. We pushed back, had them move the money, moved it to Communities for a New California, which is an organizing group that comes out of the United Farm Workers Movement. They knocked on 30,000 doors, did phone calls, turned out the vote. We won that seat by 800 votes.
Amazing.
Favorite story from 2018, but it shows the lack, the implications of the significance of this. Now, to your question you asked a long time ago, what are the takeaways? I think the bottom line takeaway is what we've been saying for almost a decade now, that there is a new American majority, that people of color and progressive whites, so it's the overwhelming majority of people of color and the meaningful minority of whites, is the majority of people and is the majority of voters. And what we have shown and what Julie's really unearthed in these different districts is that it's the majority in enough seats that the Democrats should control the House of Representatives. That's kind of the bottom line.
Yeah, all of that is just so, so compelling. I love that story that you shared. And I know the story so well, and I always appreciate getting reminded. They're in your books, you know, but we... It just the framing is so helpful because we, as those who follow the news and follow politics, it's just not what we're hearing. It's not the perspective we're getting. And so I think that, you know, again, like I always in these conversations with a lot of my friends, a lot of the friends, some of my best friends are progressive whites. And, you know, they get, understandably, if you're just following these reactive headlines, it's easy to get really freaked out. And then I say, we are still the majority. People of color plus progressive whites, it's the majority. And if we all vote, everyone who's eligible to vote, then we can not only take back the House, but win in every election. I still go out there with those points. And I think that people, once they hear it, you know, in the moment, they get it, but they just need to hear it more often. Julie, can you give us an overview of where things stand now in terms of how big or small the margin of control is in the House and what Dems actually need to do to win?
So, sure. Currently, Republicans, in effect, control 221 out of the 435 total seats in the U.S. House of Representatives. And I say in effect because some seats are currently vacant due to resignations and they just haven't been filled yet. They'll all be filled eventually. Democrats would then need to gain a net of 4 seats to take control of the House in November. And that's under the assumption that each of the currently vacant seats gets filled by a member from the same party that currently is holding it. And they can do it. There's not really any reason other than lack of clarity at the top levels in terms of direction and how we run this race. There should be no reason that we don't take the House, not just hold the Senate and the presidency. And that's also where the NMI comes into play, right? So most political pundits proceed from that questionable belief, right, that large chunks of the electorate are up for grabs, right? These voters are swinging back and forth between parties. One day I feel like voting for Republicans, then I decide to vote for a Democratic candidate. That's, we've talked about this many times here on the podcast, but that's just not how it works. In fact, there are reports from various, you know, based on data from all sorts of great sources, from the ANIS, the American National Election Studies data, all sorts of different places. And almost all of those indicate that it's fewer than 10% of the people who cast ballots actually would ever even be close to being open to voting for one or, you know, for more than one of the parties. And that's actually a very, very kind of at the far end of the spectrum. Most people would say it's, you know, closer to 4 or 5% who've studied this and looked at it carefully. So as a result, of course, many elections end up being the battle is about which side turns their people out more than the other. Not that, oh, who's going to be able to convince people who would have voted for the other side to switch and actually vote for my candidate, right? It's just a question of get your people out, get them to the polls, get them to turn in their mail-in ballot, get them early voting, whatever that might be. But that's where, so that's all great news for the Dems in terms of, you know, looking toward November. also, if you look at who's actually sitting in these districts, as far as who the voters are and what their interests and preferences are, there are more Democratic voters than Republican voters in most of the districts, and definitely in the ones that we're holding up as our sweet 16 of kind of the ones to focus on as far as flippables in November. In 2020, Biden won the most votes out of any candidate. There were, you know, obviously independents and write-ins and whatnot, but the candidate who won the most votes in 226 out of the 435 congressional districts was Biden. So we know that you only need 218 votes to control the House. There are 226 congressional districts where Biden won in 2020. Again, there's no reason why we can't get the people in that district to cast a ballot for the Democratic candidate for the House of Representatives.
Yeah, and I just want to emphasize this point about the incorrect understanding around swing voters, because I just heard it the other day, right? So the ANES, right, the National Electrical Studies report and analysis and, you know, all the pointy head academics, and they've got this chart looking at it over like 30, 40 years. And so they conclude that in 2020, 5.6% of the voters were swing voters. Now, I was listening to a podcast last week, The Powers That Be. I have to throw them under the bus, but they said it out loud. And so I think it's out by Puck. And then they just casually said, and 13% of the voters are swing voters.
What?
And so, but this is the mindset, right? Based, this is like a major media institution.
Based on what? Yeah.
Based upon that the guy said into a microphone, right? And so that's how it actually operates. So it's a pretty big difference and significant implications for how you spend your money and how you go about waging an election.
I also think what happens is in media coverage, because, you know, media outlets are, they're interested in getting the voices and stories and insight to the minds of people who are, on, let's say, on the fence. But because of the coverage, it can seem like that size of the population is larger.
Yeah. Yeah. And they may have been looking at, there is a report that can easily be misinterpreted as supporting that assertion. But what they were actually doing was looking at people who were independent. But when you look at who did you actually vote for over the past, say, three or four cycles, they're straight Dems. Right. And so it's like those aren't really independent people.
Yeah, it's very charitable.
There's just what's going on behind the scenes in any particular report is actually important to look at before you go and, you know, say on live or not live, but on a podcast recording that's truth and fact that you.
Yeah. So your dual identities were in conflict there, Julie. So the one hand, as a data scientist, PhD, you're assuming that they're looking at a different report. But you also, as a Beltway person, should know that people just say stuff all the time without looking at any reports at all.
At all. Yes.
Okay. So what does the NMI, the New Majority Index, actually show us, Julie, about how Democrats can flip the House? So what is it that the NMI is showing that maybe the other indices are not? And where should they be focusing their efforts according to the NMI? And where should listeners who want to help focus their energy?
So the NMI shows that there are 16 Republican held seats that are the most flippable. Those are the ones that, based on our analysis, including all of those additional factors that we talked about earlier, really need to be lifted up and are the places that we think that Democrats should be focusing resources and investing early in order to actually yield those seats we need to take back the House.
So 16, I think an easy way to remember that is that we just finished the NCAA season. The sweet spot is Sweet 16, which seems like a very manageable number. Of course, the campaigns themselves may argue otherwise, because I know there's, you know, hard work that needs to be done behind each one. But 16, okay, so we can wrap our heads around 16. And Steve, how did you and Julie and the, you know, doing the work behind the NMI, how did you decide on those 16 seats?
So what we did was we looked at the seats where a Republican is the member of Congress, but that Biden got the most votes. And so that shows that it's kind of unnaturally represented by a Republican, actually, is that the voters there are actually Biden voters, Democratic voters, and that if you, again, have high voter turnout and then you're able to actually, we should be able to take those seats back. Some of those seats, for instance, was a are recently won by Republicans, like in 2022. And so Biden got the most votes in 2020, but then the Democrats didn't come out in big enough numbers in 2022. So Republicans kind of snuck in. And so the idea is to mobilize there. So that's the essence of what we looked at, is where are there significant numbers of Biden voters, and where are there large numbers of eligible, often non-voting people of color. And so that's, you can really, by focusing on those areas, those are districts that we really should be able to go about flipping.
Okay, so drilling down further, if I'm in one of those congressional districts or helping to work on the campaign, what's your recommended strategy overall? How can those Democrats go about flipping those 16 seats locally, as well as those who are not even in those districts? Just collectively also, how can we help?
Right. So I'll say two things on that. A number of these seats are clustered geographically. And so if we have high voter turnout, and particularly clustered in California and in New York, and that there was not enough attention to voter mobilization and turnout in each of those states in 2022. And so it's just why we lost the House when we really shouldn't have. So you have that. And then there's also places where there is some overlap, like in Arizona, in places that will also be contested in terms of other races. So, but fundamentally, the lion's share of these really is in terms of California and New York. So there's that, and then we're going to be going over the course of the rest of the year, Democracy in Color is featuring different districts. And so people should be following along on that, and then they can use that to look at which candidates that they can move their money to. They're going to do small dollar contributions in ways that are more targeted and strategic.
Okay, so I'm usually the less hopeful in high stakes election season, Steve and Julie. And so I want to know how hopeful I should feel. I'm sure some listeners are wondering that too, because fool me once, right? You just said the Democrats like botched it, dropped the ball during last midterms. I remember that too. It was kind of like low-ish hanging fruit and they didn't do what needed to be done. So how hopeful should I feel this time that by election day that they will have done what needs to be done? Like, in other words, how are Democrats currently, do you feel like they're paying attention to the seats that NMI has identified as winnable? And also, what do we know about the party overall, their current strategy to win the House back? Are they making it a top priority? I hope the answer is yes.
Well, no, you raise a good point. So there's winnable in turn, like structurally, right? There are places where we've got enough Dems to be able to take a majority and win elections. The second question is, will the party and all the things that surround the party do what it takes to make that happen, right? And sometimes we get in our own way. Sometimes we fail to recognize opportunities that we should actually be seizing upon. You know, that happens. So I think for progressives, for people who, you know, consider themselves Democrats, I think it is important to really push and express a strong interest in having the party support candidates in places that, frankly, they did not go heavy for back in either 2022 or 2020. And I think that's going to be important for people to do in terms of like actions you can take, you know, go to a town hall by, you know, and say, what are we doing about the person one seat over from your seat, my favorite Democratic member of Congress? Are you doing anything to support Vallejo so that she can become the next House member and help you build a majority? That sort of thing I think is actually important for folks to do. But I would say just overall, the good news is that the latest DTRIP, which is the DCCC, the Democrats Campaign Committee that works to elect the Democrats in the House, their list of red to blue candidates includes almost all of those that we list on our Sweet 16. Oh. So that's very good news.
All right.
That
that's
there's alignment. So the districts that we've identified as winnable, they're recognizing and seeing that. And since we know that our analysis of the most flippable seats is a very solid analysis, that means that many of those on their list are as well. But, you know, as you mentioned, of course, what's really going to matter come November is how much the DTRIP and its outside counterpart, the House Majority PAC, actually funnel resources to these races early mm-hmm. enough to enable the campaigns to set up the kind of solid infrastructure that will be needed, right, to get that robust turnout. And, you know, if they do, then things will look great come November. Each cycle, we have to worry about this because it really does vary tremendously. And it's not a given that the party will, in fact, come through with the level of support that's needed.
To show them the money.
Yeah, no, let me add on to that, too, which I think is more hopeful news. The Hardys always tried. They've always tried very hard, and they've always done a lot of work, and they've always spent a lot of money. It just always hasn't been in as smart a fashion as it should be.
Mm.
So you have that reality. But one of the things that there's multiple dimensions, the new reality that the new head of the Democrats in the House is Akeem Jeffries.
Mm-hmm.
In that,
that's right.
We've known, he's an African-American from New York. And actually, I remember Amy Allison and I had dinner with him in Brooklyn like almost a decade ago. And also, well, this one, it's like amusing, but it's also relevant that he's actually quite into hip hop. Right. And that he like weaves that into some of his like speeches and things that he does. And he like he was part of the team that impeached Trump, and in, you know, from national television in front of all of the members of Congress. He's laying out the argument and then he raps and says, and if you don't know, now you know. Right.
It's
like he's got a hip hop sensibility, which is relevant because I believe my interactions with him is he has a better understanding of the diversity of the electorate and the importance of being able to appeal to that diversity in terms of mobilizing voters. And so a lot of the Democrats' historical leadership has been from a different generation, which is why they moved to Hakeem. And so I feel that I'm hopeful and optimistic both about his understanding of elections. And even in my conversations with him, this was after Brown and White had come out, he understood it at a deeper level than a lot of people in Democratic politics, the importance of mobilization, the importance of mobilizing people of color and investing in that, et cetera. So that gives me a fair amount of a cause for optimism.
Yeah, I think I loved watching. There's a clip of him out there rapping. And I was, you know, I look at that and go, that's not your whatever grandfather's era's politician. The new generation is exciting and certainly a counter to the standard sort of old image of what a politician and leader looks like in this country. So, Julie, during the last midterm election, Julie, you released a weekly post, awesome post, on the Democracy in Color blog, which focused, again, on each article that you posted, focused on one of the flippable seats. And so Democracy in Color's blog will be featuring your articles again for this Sweet 16, and you've already written one out of the 16 featuring one of the 16 districts that's flippable, and there will be another one coming out soon. Julie and Steve, also, do each of you have, for example, one particular district that you're watching closely, and if so, why? Yeah, I'm just kind of curious because there are so many, and they're each one probably has its own challenges or circumstances and story, right? And situation going on.
Sure. So the next blog is actually going to be an overview to all 16. So if people want to just kind of get a quick analysis of that, check that one out. And I'd say that as a Tejana from South Texas, I cannot help but be fixated on the Texas 15 race. It's a rematch of 2022 with two young Latinas who are vying for that seat. And the seat is gerrymandering left and right in Texas, of course. So this seat's a long and narrow strip that runs from the far east of San Antonio, and it goes straight down to the Mexican border. It's a district that's over 81% Latino, and it's currently held, pulling my hair out here, by a Republican and a freshman right now, she's in her very first term, Monica De La Cruz. And she beat Michelle Vallejo, the Democrat, by almost 10 points in the midterm, which would make you think, oh, why is she the candidate again? She lost by 10 points. Well, the party just really did not back her. They made a strategic decision to focus resources on protecting incumbents who were having to run in seats that had been newly drawn. And just really chose to not put a lot of resources into the Texas 15 race. So this time they've learned a lesson, and I'm anticipating that they are indeed going to come through with the sort of support that she's going to need to be able to make it through. So I'm really hopeful. She's a great candidate.
Awesome. So that's Michelle Vallejo.
And then I'm really looking at, in Arizona, right, at Raquel Turan's race, which is the Arizona 3rd Congressional District. And so it's a fairly Democratic seat, but it's an important race because it's kind of a threefer to a certain extent. So first of all, as I, you know, I have a whole chapter in How We Win the Civil War on Arizona. And I try to explain how the evolution and transformation of Arizona's politics goes back to the very hostile anti-immigrant law that was passed in 2010, SB 1070, the Show Me Your Papers law. That law radicalized, politicized, galvanized a whole grouping and a whole generation of young activists who have created civic engagement groups, done voter registration, registered and brought into the electorate 500,000 Latinos over the past decade. And that was responsible for Biden winning, for the Democrats winning in the Senate, for Katie Hobbs winning as governor. So all of that is in place. So Raquel was a key leader in all of that. And she was very, that's where her roots are from the 2010 piece. She recruited people into the movement, such as Alex Gomez out of Lucha. And so she's an anchor of the movement. So she has that sensibility. And she was most recently in the state legislature. So, but she's running for the seat that was held by Ruben Gallego, who's running for the U.S. Senate, and who's hopefully we're going to actually have on the podcast in a future episode. Woo-hoo. So the significance of Raquel's race is that because she's an organizer, a lot of times people who have fairly safe seats don't do a lot of attention to voter mobilization and turnout, and they're not that focused on that. But by maximizing the turnout in her district is also going to help Ruben win that Senate seat, and it's also going to help Biden win the state. So that's why I think that race is a really kind of a linchpin that has multiple benefits to it.
That's awesome. And I have a quick question, which is, where can people find the list of the 16?
Well, Julie, you said your next blog is going to be all 16 of them, right?
Yeah.
So it's going to be on the Democracy in Color blog. This will be out contemporaneous, fingers crossed, with the pod. So when people hear this, they can go to Democracy in Color. They can see the blog, and they'll list all the 16 seats.
Awesome. And then last question, what can the average person do to help?
I think people should follow along Dr. Martinez Ortega's journey, like through the congressional districts, right? So back when Stephen Colbert had his show on Comedy Central, he had this thing about, you know a district, and they do little features. And so people should follow along, see who the person is, and then they should support each of those people if it captures their imagination, the different candidates who we're featuring, and then send them a little love money each time the blog comes out, and that'll be linked in the blog post so you can actually get access to them. So I think that's a way to participate in an ongoing way over the next several months in ways that make a contribution in strategic places, in strategic ways to helping take back the House.
All right, you guys, you heard it. It's a next steps. And I can't wait to get into that list myself and see what I might be able to do. I'm in California, and pay more attention and find out what those flippable seats are via the NMI.
All right. Well, thank you both. Thank you, Julie, for beaming in from the Beltway. And thank you, Charlene, as always, for beaming in from Berkeley. And that is all the time we have for today. Thank you for listening to Democracy in Color with Steve Phillips. Please help us get the word out about this podcast by subscribing wherever you get your podcast and sharing with your friends, tweeting at Democracy Color and at Steve P. Tweets, and finding us at Democracy in Color on Facebook or Instagram. You can also keep up with all things DEMCO by subscribing to our newsletter at democracyincolor.com. If you listen to our podcast on iTunes, please leave us a rating and a comment. It helps others to find our show. This podcast is a Democracy in Color production. Our producer is Olivia Parker. Fola Onifade is our staff writer and associate producer. Charlene Chang is our editor and co-host. Special thanks to April Elkier for Quality Check. Recorded virtually with the assistance of the podcast studio of San Francisco. Until next time, keep the faith.